From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on November 16th during an interview on Megyn Kelly's show on Fox News. It was a conversation about a proposal to ban Muslim immigrants. Donald Trump, of course, had promised exactly such a ban during the campaign. Trump's advisors had spoken openly after his election about a plan to create a registry, and so Megyn Kelly, among others, she was asking why. Her guest was Carl Higbee, a former Navy SEAL and a Donald Trump surrogate. And Higbee said that there is legal precedent for a registry or a ban. He cited Japanese internment from World War II. Higbee's remarks set off a storm of response and a series of conflicting comments from Trump and his own staff. For Japanese Americans, the comments were understandably offensive, a painful reminder of a terrible chapter in history. The University of Rochester is hosting an exhibit now titled Looking Like the Enemy, the World War II Japanese American Experience. That exhibit runs through this coming Sunday. We'll tell you about that coming up. And our hope on Connections is not to forget the past so that we might avoid repeating mistakes. This is a conversation about the remarks and about the realities of internment. And internment as legal precedent, as sort of unbelievable as that sounds, it's still a conversation. So let me go ahead and welcome our guest for the hour. Joanne Bernardi is an associate professor of Japanese and film and media studies and head of the Japanese program at the University of Rochester. Professor Bernardi, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And three other guests all have personal stories to share in different ways. So Ken Warner is here, and Ken is someone you've probably heard talking about issues related to labor and many other issues over the years. He's got a family connection, so what's the brief, we'll talk more about this, but what's the brief snapshot on your family connection here, Ken?
My grandmother was in Hawaii during World War II, and previous to that, my mother was there, and so that makes me a quarter Japanese. It's interesting to note that they interned people with as little as a 16th.
And your grandmother, Mitsui Akuma, and yeah. We'll be talking about some of your family experiences and how now that affects the way you look at the current conversation. Also here are Notch and Margaret Miyake, and they spent time in 2013. Well, they've been on the road a lot. In fact, if you read about Notch and Margaret, they've motorcycle trips, photography, trips around the country. But they took a trip in 2013, and Notch and Margaret, can you just briefly tell us what the mission was in 2013? And Notch, try to get right on that microphone for me. Go ahead.
It originally started because of an interest of long-term interest of mine in the Japanese American history, particularly those the people in Hawaii, but also the experience of the Japanese on the West Coast. So what we wanted to do was to go around and see all of the Japanese internment camps, just take a look and see what was there. It was partly a way of escaping Rochester spring pollen and partly just to satisfy some curiosity of ours. As the trip developed, it turned really more into a pilgrimage. Pilgrimage is a way of learning new things about yourself and about reaffirming a lot of your personal values and interests. And so we ended up calling it a pilgrimage, and that's what it was really all about. Visits to places resonate with spiritual and historic significance.
Margaret, just some brief thoughts from you on that experience.
Well, I grew up in South Carolina, so I had no awareness of this going on. But certainly, I've grown up in an area where there's quite a bit of racial discrimination. But when we undertook this trip, not trying to get away from Rochester's pollen allergies, well, we went right into the midst of the Midwest where it's so brutal and hot. But as we were journeying, I wanted to take pictures. But what do you take pictures of? This dust, this sagebrush, this cracked soil, because all of these places were so desolate. So it was a real challenge and, for me, a wonderful experience to go where no one else wants to go. There were no tourists there. There were no water stations where you could buy a bottle of water. There were no crowds. It was just silence and emptiness. And to think that over 120,000 Japanese Americans had been uprooted along the West Coast and sent inland to these places, and yet they survived and came out with dignity and honor. And it was, for me, a wonderful experience.
Well, let's listen, if we could, to those remarks that I referenced off the top that has sparked so much conversation. This is from The Megyn Kelly Show, Megyn Kelly's show on Fox News, with Carl Higbee, again, a former Navy SEAL and a Trump surrogate, talking about the possibility of using Japanese internment as a legal precedent for a future registry or ban of any person of some kind.
Trump's policy advisors are discussing drafting a proposal to reinstate a registry for immigrants from Muslim countries,
Yeah, and perfectly honest, it is legal. They say it'll hold constitutional muster. I know the ACLU is going to challenge it, but I think it'll pass. And we've done it with Iran back a while ago. We did it during World War II with Japanese, which, you know, call it what you
Come
will,
on.
maybe
you're
wrong.
Not, you're not proposing we go back to the days of internment camps, I hope.
No. I'm not proposing that at all, Megan. But what I am saying is that we need to protect
that.
America.
I mean, that's the kind of stuff that gets people scared, Carl.
Right. But I'm just saying there is precedent for it. And I'm not saying I agree with it. But in this case, I absolutely believe that a regional
base... You can't be citing Japanese internment camps as precedent for anything the president-elect is going
to
do.
Look, the president needs to protect America first. And if that means having people that are not protected under our Constitution have some sort of registry so we can understand, until we can identify the true threat and where it's coming from, I support it.
Okay. And after that happened, there were some conflicting comments from Trump's own camp on this. Many of his surrogates have said that's true. And the New York Times editorial board wrote an editorial titled 1942 All Over Again with a question mark. Let me just read from this because I confess my own ignorance on historical precedent and where things stood in the court. So let me just read from this and we'll talk about this. In 1944, the Supreme Court upheld that order of internments, the order's constitutionality. Writing for the majority in Korematsu versus United States, Justice Hugo Black said Americans of Japanese descent were incarcerated, quote, because we are at war with the Japanese Empire, not because of racial hostility, end quote. But that was obviously untrue, as Justice Black himself suggested in an interview decades later, saying that, quote, people were rightly fearful of the Japanese because to non-Japanese people, they all look alike, end quote. Today, the Korematsu decision is widely regarded as one of the court's most shameful, but it has never been overturned because the issue hasn't come up again. How much will all of that matter in the coming months and years? The consensus among lawyers and legal scholars has long been that the ruling is so thoroughly discredited, as Justice Stephen Breyer wrote in his book in 2010, that it is hard to conceive of any future court referring to it favorably or relying on it, end quote. And yet here we are. Joanne Bernardi, take me through just some of your reaction to the rhetoric you're hearing and the fact that the Times is pointing out this is never officially overturned. We might be staring right at this again. What do you think?
Well, the rhetoric really began almost to a day of Carl Higbee's interview, a year to the day, in November of 2015, when the mayor of Roanoke, David Bowers, referred to the need to stop immigration. I think he wanted to stop all aid to Syrian immigrants by referring to the internment camps and referring to FDR's decision as something that we need to revisit, as if it were a good idea. And the mistake he made was that he referred to the internment as being limited to Japanese citizens. He later apologized for that, but that was a huge red flag for me, that someone clearly didn't know their history, that he was referring to the internment as a model of something that might be useful in this day and age in terms of present immigration situations. Then that was followed by Donald Trump holding a rally on Pearl Harbor Day last year, and that was when he made his announcement. He made it shortly before the rally, but he started the rally by making those comments again about the need to halt all immigration until, and I think his quote was, until we can figure out what's going on.
Right. Do you think he's just ignorant of the historical context on Pearl Harbor Day to say something like that?
Well, that was my initial reaction. He was questioned about internment and what he felt about internment. And in both Time and I think on ABC News, he said he actually didn't know what he would have done. He really couldn't pass judgment on the internment. Those were his words. He couldn't say if it was a good or a bad thing. Although when he was later asked if he would favor internment for Syrian immigrants, he said no, he would not do that. But it was clear that he had ambivalent feelings, or at least, you know, felt it was okay to express ambivalent feelings about the internment, the Japanese-American internment, which is a historical fact.
Let me ask Ken Warner kind of a two-pronged question, because first of all, as someone of Japanese descent, I want your reaction to what you're hearing. But also, Ken, as someone who has worked in politics in a strategic way on campaigns, you understand that there are certain games that are played at times, or certain rhetoric in campaigns, not at all excusing it. I'm asking you, given both of those parts of your background, if you took Trump seriously, if you have legitimate concerns that you feel like that wasn't just rhetoric from a campaign, that we should be gravely worried about this.
And how long do I have to do this?
Yeah.
You know, actually, when I heard it, I was outraged. And I was outraged not only for myself, but for this community that we live in Rochester, New York. A little known fact is that there are over 5,000 refugees, many of them Asian, but also from the Middle East and Syria, who live in Northwest Rochester. And we're taking in about 1,000 a year. These people are forgotten in this community. If we take 1,000 a year over the next 10 years, that means it's going to be a substantial population in that part of the community, over 15,000. I personally have not been the recipient of a great deal of discrimination regarding my ancestry because I look like my father, who was an Irish guy. My brother, on the other hand, looked very much like my mother, who was half Japanese, and actually moved from this community back to Hawaii at the age of 18 and never returned except for an occasional visit because of it. It's outrageous. And what's even more outrageous, or equally outrageous, is the fact that we even call them internment camps. Remember when this happened? If we were in Germany, they'd be concentration camps. And there is a big debate that has gone on over the years about the discussion as to what they should be called.
To you, they're concentration camps?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. Not only are they concentration camps, but the thing people have to understand and is that they also interred Germans and Italians, not to the same numbers, but the fact, and 62% of the people who were put in these, what I call concentration camps, were United States citizens. You had no protections under the Fifth Amendment and habeas corpus. It is outrageous.
And going forward, we should take it very seriously?
We should absolutely take it very seriously. You know, the odd thing about it is, and I was just joking about this a little bit prior to us starting the show, that friends of mine who have found out, you know, as I say, I'm known as a resident white guy, friends of mine have said over the years, as I've told them about my ancestry, then they look at me and say, I always thought there was something funny about you. And that's the way people are when racism and discrimination starts to take place. At first, you're just my neighbor. And then there's something funny about you.
Notch and Margaret, your thoughts on, first of all, I guess let me just kind of back up to when this flared up about a week after Donald Trump's election, and we started hearing, you know, the Korematsu of the United States and possible legal precedent. I'm curious to know not only your thoughts about that, but your thoughts in the context of the fact that, from what I've read in previous interviews that you have done, you consider it a very important work that you have done to try to educate the American public about what happened with, as Ken says, concentration camps, internment. So, Margaret, he's pointing at you. You can go ahead. Go ahead. Is it fair to say that given your passion for making sure this country doesn't lose sight of what happened, that this moment is maybe more important than ever, given
this? Oh, definitely. Yeah. Very important, because what we saw we first visited Manzanar, the first quote camp to open about 20 years ago, and the only thing that was there was the white obelisk that Ansel Adams had photographed mm-hmm. in 1943, and we thought, what do we have here that documents that maybe close to 10,000 people were incarcerated here? So our trip went, and we saw the remains from the past of just the foundations for barracks. We saw empty fields, and as I mentioned, just dust. And we wanted to some way share this, and we've been very, very fortunate that both Joanne Bernardi at the University of Rochester and Randy Kaplan at the Geneseo both permitted us to have exhibits to display these images and to share our experiences of traveling across country, because it's been an inhumane way that these people, I hate to even use that term, these people, how 120,000 Japanese Americans were just uprooted. They lost their land, they lost their jobs, they lost their houses, they lost their respect from their neighbors, their dignity, and were just sent to these concentration camps. A concentration camp is a camp where civilians, enemy aliens, and political prisoners are detained and confined, typically under harsh conditions. Most American officials rejected and resented use of this term applied to the War Relocation Authority camps. But President Roosevelt used the phrase to describe the camps for Japanese Americans on more than one occasion. So if there's some way that we can help disseminate this information and help others understand and not stereotype and make judgments, mm-hmm. because some of us look a little different.
Yeah. Notch, how do you feel?
Well, I think it's very important that as many people in this country understand what happened in the Second World War with the Japanese Americans. I think we're facing a similar kind of situation as we look at the terrorist threat in this country. The Congressional Commission that investigated the internment called it a failure of, well, called, blamed it on race prejudice, political failure.
War hysteria.
War hysteria and a failure of political leadership.
Right. That's right.
And I think all those conditions present today, where we could get another one of these, this type of injustice happen again. So yes, I think that's my primary motivation.
Okay. Well, let me just make sure, before too much more time passes, that I let you know a couple of things. Joanne Bernardi from the University of Rochester, can you just let the audience know where they can go and what they can see through this coming Sunday, the exhibit that is still there?
Sure. The Hartnett Gallery is on the second floor of Wilson Commons at the University of Rochester. The exhibit is free and open to the public. It's open from, I believe, noon to 5 o'clock. The Hartnett Gallery does have a website, and you can find the times there.
We'll post it on our Twitter feeds, and we'll also post it attached to this podcast if you want to check it out.
Okay, it is open on Saturdays and Sundays. Sunday will be the last day, and what they will find are Margaret Miyake's photographs annotated with text and contextualized by Notch Miyake, and artifacts from my Re-Envisioning Japan collection, which contains World War II anti-Japanese propaganda, political buttons, postcards, sheet music. And we also have running a film clip with a short 9-minute film by the War Relocation Agency called Japanese Internment, and narrated by Mitt Eisenhower, I think, who was mm-hmm. the head of that of the internment action. And there's also a clip from United News about building modern homes for Jap Americans, I think is the title. And then clips from the feature film that was made in 1951 that Notch told me about called Gopher Broke, which is about the 442nd military unit that was composed of Japanese Americans, the most highly decorated unit and also suffering the most casualties for its size during World War II.
Joanne, I'm looking at some of the items, the postcards especially.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even read many of them. They are there's just pure racism, hatred and racism.
Right.
And can I just take a moment to let our audience know, you can call the program, and I didn't live through World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to keep perspective. I mean, we'd gone through a national tragedy with Pearl Harbor. The world was at war. Sentiment to win the war was running high. There was obviously a lot of emotion. So I know it was a different time, and I know it was a different sort of national moment. I just look at these and I think, I can't, even in that context, it's tough.
But that's a good thing, because that means that would not happen today. Postcards.
Are we sure it wouldn't?
Well, I think, at least we're not seeing postcards like that and sheet music like that and political buttons
but
like that
But we see
yet.
Twitter memes.
Well, that's true.
I mean, that's sort of the modern postcard,
true.
Do we not?
That's
we do.
True. Yeah.
And that's what sort of concerns me. And I don't mean to be a moral scold here either.
Right,
I mean,
no.
Like the last thing people, trust me, I get emails all the time when I start to sound high and mighty, and I don't ever want to be that kind of a host. I want to be sort of be open-minded and understanding different experiences, but it's really tough. When you look at what Joanne has compiled for this exhibit in the Re-Envisioning Japan collection there, that you can see at this exhibit through Sunday, it's really tough to look at. So listeners, call the program. And first of all, let us know if you're concerned, if this is a moment where you think, if you think that the next administration is on to something that should be happening. I mean, maybe you're disagreeing with some of the sentiment you're hearing here. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI. If you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We always want to honor voices from all sides of this discussion. So no matter where you are, we'd love to hear from you on this. And I see the phone ringing. We'll get to that in a moment. But Joanne, what do you want people who come to this exhibit to sort of walk away with?
I think it's important that we think about Pearl Harbor and the bombing of Hiroshima as bookends, and the internment is what's in between. Howard Zinn talks about the emotions that were going on at the time, the psychological atmosphere that made it okay to drop an atomic bomb on Japan. I think that was the emotional environment that also made it okay for this kind of racist propaganda to be accepted and tolerated by otherwise very decent people. So I guess I would like people to reflect and look inward, which sort of reminds me of, President Obama's words at Hiroshima. He didn't say an apology for Hiroshima, which, that's okay. He said instead, let's look inward. Let's think of ourselves as well as the enemy, rather than this kind of knee-jerk reaction to other people, to not react with this sense of moral self-righteousness, but remember instead that, we're talking about humankind and looking at history in a holistic way.
Ken, go ahead, Ken.
I think what she's saying is very, very important, mm-hmm. because I want to refer to this 1980 report that President Carter had done, where, and in fact, they one of the reasons why people did this was because they thought Japanese were going to be a fifth column, that they were going to be terrorists, that they're going to be killing, murdering, and all the rest of it. The fact is, though, that they weren't at all. And this commission concluded that the incarceration had been, in fact, the product of racism, and they found very little evidence of Japanese disloyalty. The reason I bring that up is, and the reason it's so important today, is the profiling that takes place against people of Middle Eastern descent. we walk down the street and think, oh, is that a terrorist? Are they going to, you know, pull? Are they going to blow up the Walmart? Or that? And it's a hysteria that we are only a fraction of an inch of sanity away from. And we do need to do exactly that. We need to look inside to make sure that we don't do it to the next set of neighbors.
Yeah, I think, too, if you look at propaganda from World War II, postcards, for example, that show the Axis powers, Germany is represented by Hitler. Italy is represented by Mussolini. So Germany and Italy are represented by recognizable individuals, but Japan is represented always by a kind of cipher, an Asian cipher, buck teeth, glasses, squinty eyes. So it's a caricature of an entire race and ethnicity. It's a caricature that speaks of racism in ways that did not quite those dynamics were not quite the same for Germany and for Italy. So I think the racism becomes really blatant if we put it in that context.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back to your phone calls. And we're going to spend the rest of the hour letting the audience drive the conversation. Joanne Bernardi, who you just heard, is an associate professor of Japanese and film and media studies and head of the Japanese program at the University of Rochester. Notch and Margaret Miyake are here. They have done a lot of work to photograph what remains of where the so-called internment camps were. They did that in 2013, and they've been working to make sure Americans understand what happened during Japanese internment. And Ken Warner is here as well, talking about his own family history. Ken, the descendant of Japanese Americans and Japanese in Hawaii primarily, Ken, right? Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Talking about his experience and his family's experience and what we should be talking about at this historical moment. With some in the next administration, or at least allies and surrogates in the next administration, using Japanese internment as a potential legal precedent. So let's get that short break and come back to your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, it's a small business success story, a small business challenge story, and what we can learn from the owners of Eat Me Ice Cream. Their business turned 5 years old recently. They've grown a lot in the last couple of years. But some of the challenges they face, well, if you're thinking about becoming a small business owner, you probably want to know what might be in front of you. I think we can learn a lot from them next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Mary in Spencerport is first up on the phones. Go ahead, Mary.
I just recently read a book called Midnight in Broad Daylight, which it's a true story about a Japanese-American family caught between the two worlds. And in there, it talks about how the prejudice really predated World War II. They actually had the Washington State alien land law that prohibited those ineligible for citizenship to own land. So the Japanese were denied that path to citizenship. They couldn't own land, so they started buying land in the name of their American-born children who were citizens. But then they closed that loophole. So there's the prejudice goes back long before the war. And I think that probably influenced the fears of people out there. That's my comment.
Okay. Thank you, Mary, for the phone call. Some thoughts from the panel on that?
California.
Notch, go ahead, Notch.
Yeah, there's been a long-standing history of racial discrimination against Asians. The Asian Exclusion Act of 1924 was an official expression of American racism. I mean, it's built in. The Naturalization Act of 1870 limited naturalization to immigrants who were free white persons of good character. After the Civil War and the freeing of the slaves, blacks were included as part of it. But before that, they were not allowed to become citizens. It wasn't until 1952 that the Immigration Act in 1952 eliminated all race as a basis for naturalization. So I mean, this is long ingrained in the American system. Japanese-American immigrants who came from Japan were not allowed to become citizens until 1952. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a long history of discrimination against against Japanese and Asian Americans. And of course, it is no different than discrimination against blacks and other minority groups in this country. So, yeah, I think it's a real thing.
Let me just read a couple of quick emails before I get back to your phone calls. Bob writes to the program and says, it is at times of crisis that we need to stick to the Constitution. Acting on fear only gives us results like Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Patriot Act. That's from Bob weighing in. Barry writes to us and says, pre-World War II, some German Americans had pro-Nazi rallies at Madison Square Garden, in addition to other pro-Nazi activities throughout our country, and yet it was 110,000 Japanese Americans who wound up in internment camps. German POWs, soldiers who tried to kill our GIs, were housed at Cobbs Hill and were given free range in our community and even worked here. Now there is a threat to returning to this mentality. Did America learn nothing from this embarrassing situation, which as a country under Reagan we have apologized and paid reparations for? And I think that's right. If you don't remember the history of reparations, correct me if I'm wrong, 87 or 88, and it was a $20,000 payment to all surviving?
88, right. Uh-huh.
$20,000 payment.
And I think it was 70,000 people who received reparations.
Okay. So So reparations in this case did happen. Go ahead, Ken.
You know, I want to refer to the first email and the Constitution argument. Former Supreme Court Justice Tom Clark, who had represented the U.S. Department of Justice in this relocation, wrote in the 1992 book, Executive Order 9066, The Internment of 110,000 Japanese Americans, and I quote, "The truth is, as this deplorable experience proves, that constitutions and laws are not sufficient of themselves. Despite the unequivocal language of the Constitution of the United States that the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended, and despite the Fifth Amendment's command that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, both of these constitutional safeguards were denied by military action and under the executive order." We cloak ourselves in the Constitution all the time. That's what makes this so outrageous. We think we're protected, but we're not.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. Danny in Brighton. Go ahead, Danny.
Hi. First, let me preface my remarks by just saying that I am a child of Holocaust survivors. So throughout my childhood, I heard stories. And one of the ones that really scares me now in relation to what I'm hearing about Trump's ideas is that we are moving into a state that's all too similar to what my parents experienced. And there's one example that I just want to give you, and that is, I don't know if you know that the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, is the holiest of all Jewish holidays. And the Nazis made all the Jews in Austria-Hungary turn in all their radios and shortwave equipment on the Day of Atonement. One, they have to work on the Day of Atonement, that is, carry things that they weren't supposed to, and then give up all their communication with the rest of the world. And where the other day, I don't know if you remember this, and I checked it with Snopes to make sure, Trump made a statement about the Internet, that he wanted to talk to Bill Gates, perhaps about managing it or controlling it. Now, I know that China does that, but that's not what's supposed to happen in the United States. And so when I hear this conversation that we're having this morning, you know, my parents were not in concentration camps. They were in civilian camps, separate camps, and lost from each other for 13 months in France, where the French Vichy government put anybody who was German-speaking, which they were, into camps and were treated savagely. So when I hear about this, I'm in shock. I cannot believe that this is happening again in the United States. And for the first time in my life, I'm saying to myself, I'm grateful that my parents are not alive to see this happening again.
Danielle, thank you for the phone call. I don't know if anybody in the studio wants to weigh in on that. I think you just got a lot of feelings of solidarity and nods around the table. Yeah, a lot of people are feeling those historical parallels that Danielle brings up. Patrick writes to us and says, on the campaign trail, Donald Trump had no compunction about getting crowds worked up enough to chant, lock her up, about Hillary Clinton. And with minor encouragement, these same voters might be swayed against the other of the day, starting with those who appear to be from the Middle East. Thank you and your panel for having this conversation that reminds us that this is not normal. This is not America. That's from Patrick. Go ahead, Margaret.
I was asked, why take these photographs? Why travel and visit these internment camps? And the man approached me and said, you don't realize they were our enemy. I could hear on the radio the Marche de Bataan. This was awful what they were doing. And your photographs, you're sort of glorifying. And I didn't have a response. I was just speechless. I didn't know how to respond to him. But then later I realized, as you know, Joanne's pointing out, you have to internalize what someone says and understand. And the 120,000 elderly men, pregnant women, little children, mothers, fathers, high school students, they were not the enemy. All of these were Americans or Japanese aliens who had given up their lives and relocated to another country. And why did we have to attack them? They were not our enemy. Sure, we were at war. I understand that, in hysteria. But it crossed the line.
Notch, you want to weigh in too? Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to make one point, which is relevant to what's going on today. You must understand that this action was done, the internment was done by executive order. That means that it did not have to have congressional review. Okay, it's very important. That's one of the safeguards in our system. And because this was done as an executive order and because it was later not ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, means that the president can, if he chooses, do the exact same thing by executive order. Now, that's an important consideration. I think all of us ought to be aware that even more easily could happen today.
And one quick question to follow that point, and I think that's an important point that Notch makes before I get back to the phones, which are flooded. And I'll direct this to Ken Warner again, who's done a lot of work in politics. This president, President Barack Obama, has had a number of executive orders, and I think a number of orders that progressive Americans have said, well, that makes sense. This is something that needs to be done. But he kind of worked around Congress at times. And I think a lot of progressives have felt like, well, that was the only way to get certain things done. But Barack Obama campaigned in 2008 on transparency, on curtailing executive power. He hasn't really governed on pulling back executive power. And I think if progressives like some of his executive orders, I'm still wondering, does that set the precedent for extending executive power, and then all of a sudden the next president may use that in a way that you don't like? Is that a valid concern?
I suppose that it is, but we also have to remember that one of the reasons he had to do that is because one of the political parties in the country has been blocking every move in Congress.
But Ken, you got to win elections, right?
You do have to win elections, but even when you win, it doesn't mean anything because, lest we forget, Hillary Clinton still is 2.6 million votes ahead, and she's not there.
She didn't win that election, though. That's not the way that system works. She won the popular vote,
right,
and that does not set the presidency right now.
Correct.
For now.
But nevertheless, my point being that the executive order is something that you can use, but there's a moral compass that we're supposed to have when we elect a president of the United States.
Sure.
And the reason that I bring up the number of votes is because I'm not sure that he's representing the majority of people in the moral compass that he's advocating, Donald Trump. And that's the part that's inherent in democracy. When you elect somebody as your representative, they're truly supposed to be doing that, representing your feelings. I'm not sure that that what we can come to expect out of the coming presidency. You know, you start to think about yourself, by the way, that when I'm sitting here on this show with you, when we're all sitting here talking about this, that we've now given evidence as to what we think. And they used that sort of evidence against people in the past.
In authoritarian regimes, they have.
J. Edgar Hoover did it in the United States of America, and he was head of the FBI.
wasn't that long ago.
Not that long ago.
In the scope of history. Well, speaking of experience on this, Joan in Henrietta wants to join the conversation as well. Go ahead, Joan.
Hi. I'm 81 now, and I grew up in a town in Washington State, not far from Tacoma. And we had that internment kind of in that town where I grew up. And so I saw it. They fenced all these people in. My father owned a drugstore there in that town, and he knew a lot of those people. And he was really upset and, you know, just said that they're good people. Also, what aggravated him is they gave all the Japanese farmers, they gave their farms to Filipinos. And so, really, they took everything they had from these people. And like he said, they were good people. So I just want to say that not everybody certainly was for that at the time. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Jim. Thanks for the phone call. Yeah, so a range of experience and perspectives. And speaking of, let's get someone who thinks that Trump is onto something. That's John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. The internment camps, that's definitely something I don't agree with, that Trump I don't think he's proposed it. He didn't mention it. But I think he's onto something in regards to vetting of Muslims from certain countries in the Middle East, such as Syria, which have been hotbeds of Islamists. And I've heard, I think James Comey and a number of FBI higher-ups, including, I think, James Clapper, who have said our vetting process is not good enough. And having said that, Trump is definitely onto something. We're going to have to restrict immigration to the United States until the vetting process is improved. I guess I'd like to get your comments on that.
Okay. Guess who wants to weigh in first there?
Well, I think I was trying to think of this example where at one of the problems that one of the I think it was the attack on in Benghazi on the American embassy, where a highly placed government official believed that Iranians were responsible for it, even though there was no evidence of it. And what he did was he told his staff, no, your job is to go out and find that evidence. And when they would come back and tell him that there isn't any, he'd send them out again and eventually removed some of them because they weren't giving him the answer that he wanted. This idea that we have to keep vetting until we get the answer only means that someone turns around and gives you the answer you're looking for. Weapons of mass destruction. I mean, we still have to understand that we need to look into ourselves and make sure that we're not making that mistake. We're not thinking ourselves that this is okay.
But Ken, John is concerned that there are people who might come to this country from a certain part of the world that pose a particular concern or threat. That seems to be what he's saying. We've heard that from Donald Trump. So Ken, what do you say?
Well, as Lieutenant General John DeWitt said in his editorial, A Jap's a Jap, and then testified to Congress, quote, I don't want any of them, persons of Japanese ancestry, here. They are a dangerous element. There is no way to determine their loyalty. It makes no difference whether he is an American citizen. He's still a Japanese. American citizenship does not necessarily determine loyalty, but we must worry about the Japanese all the time until he's wiped off the map. This is outrageous. I don't really think that we should be doing that for Syrians or anybody.
Well, I think it's outrageous. The comment you're trying to tie Trump to that statement, I think that's outrageous.
I'm not surprised.
Thank you, John. Let's get back to the phones, and let me turn now to Roy in Rochester, who's been waiting. Go ahead, Roy.
Good morning, Evan. Yes. I grew up in Oregon, the Red Republic out on the other end of the country. And my college job was working in a furniture store moving Thomasville chinas and things like that. And my bosses, everybody else was Japanese in that company. And over time, I learned from my fellow truck driver, who was the only one who really talked, they'd all been in the camps, every last one of them. Nobi, Ted, Helen, Tomo. In fact, the company was named after the child who died of carbon monoxide poisoning in the camp, Byron. And they were great people, but they never talked about it. And that was the 70s. But my thought about that is, especially after your one of the last calls there, was it's not just Korematsu. The court during that entire period had things. In Rikirin, we could hold a government, we could hold a military tribunal, try German saboteurs who were landed on the Atlantic coast and send them to death, all done in Washington, D.C. very quickly. And in the post 9/11 era, John Yoo, a very effective tool, wrote a book, a deeply sincere and almost kindly guy. I've talked to him, but I think he's crack smoking stupid in terms of if the president thinks it's all right, it could be done. And if Donald Trump has campaigned for the highest office in this land, I think he ran for boss, not for president, and that we can expect a lot more trouble.
Well, Roy, let me just jump in and say that Kellyanne Conway, who advises and has helped Donald Trump's campaign, said recently she was asked about some of Donald Trump's behavior and comments since becoming president, not the least of which is making stuff up on Twitter and then defending it without evidence. And she was asked, you know, is what he's saying and doing presidential? And she said, essentially, well, he's the president-elect, so it is by definition presidential. And that kind of dovetails with what Roy is saying, is that when you are the president, you can determine that anything you do is presidential or is allowed. And that is the question going forward. Is that what we're going to be looking at? I don't know the answer to that. I want to grab one more phone call from Sam in Rochester. Go ahead, Sam.
Thank you, Evan, for taking my call.
Sure.
But see, this has been one of the problems with America for a while. When they're confronted. Now, when they do these things, they're always happy, they rejoice, and this is not all of America. But then when history starts to repeat itself and the America is confronted with some of the outrageous things that they did, they don't want to be confronted with it because they don't want to say, yeah, we did that, but it was glorification when they did it. Now, you take back in history according to the census in 1940, there was 127,000 persons of Japanese ancestry that lived in the United States, and most of them lived on the West Coast. Now, those camps was not a place of leisure. They were not a place where they put them and they just sit back, relax, and rest. Those people suffered. And why is it that we can't sit down and talk to each other with respect? And, you know, we're never going to get to know each other if we can't respect each other and talk to each other. Communication is one of the best dialogues we can have. And I think this president that's going out of office has proved that in his 8 years as president of the United States.
All right, I've got to jump in, Sam, because we're going to be out of time. But on that question of are we not good at confronting our own history, let me ask the professor, Joanne Bernardi, what do you think?
Yeah, I keep thinking about, you know, the caller who said, you know, who made the point about the necessity of vetting. I think, though, the sentiment that surrounds all of this dialogue that we're having is not really rational. It's a dialogue that's really rooted in retribution. And retribution is not a solution. It's not a solution to anything. It's the go-to feeling that people have when they are cobbled by nationalistic sentiment.
And it's probably pretty easily exploitable in certain moments, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, just looking at the postcards and some of the items that you've compiled for this exhibit, it's heavily retribution based.
Yep.
And that sort of green lighted some of the racism that we saw in the imagery.
Yep. And you know, it was the after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki that people really started to talk about the world, the globe, the world holistically as the target and not a specific nation. And the idea that the world seen from space has no national boundaries. It has no national boundaries, and that, you know, when we do something to harm a certain nation, we're really doing something to harm ourselves.
Yeah, the boundaries that we create. Well, I want to thank you all for coming in and discussing this at this moment, this moment in our American history. And again, you can see the exhibit that Joanne was talking about through Sunday, real quick.
Yes.
Through Sunday, yes.
Hartnett Gallery, second floor of Wilson Commons at the University of Rochester.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Ken Warner, thank you for sharing your experience and your perspective. And Notch and Margaret, really remarkable work that you both have done. And thank you for sharing your perspective as well.
Thank you very much.
All right, short break. More Connections next.